Today's episode of Real Ghost Stories Online is brought to you by the new podcast called Haunted Places. It's not ours, but it's a good one. Visit Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you download podcasts, and search for it, Haunted Places.
There was definitely something that happened to these people that was earth-shattering and completely has shaken up their lives.
If you want access to the best real ghost stories,
I think she was afraid that they were going to make her little friend go away.
Real accounts of the dead coming back to life.
She had a spirit that she had gotten very close with.
Real video and images of ghosts.
A little boy.
Then you need to be an extra podcast person, also known as an EPP. Sign up to be one for only $5 a month at ghostpodcast.com.
I stared transfixed as the mist began to gradually become more solid and translucent, and to my shock, more human in appearance.
Your support is what keeps our show on the air. For only $5, you'll have access to hundreds of EPP exclusive episodes, updated weekly, exclusive video content, and more.
Behind me in my kitchen, I hear a little girl say, "Are you my daddy? Where's my daddy?"
Keep us on the air and get access to the best ghost stories and more now at ghostpodcast.com. And thanks for your support.
Stories Online. Call in your real ghost story now at 855-853-4802 or write in at realghoststoriesonline.com. You are about to enter the world of the unknown and quite possibly the undead. This is Real Ghost Stories Online.
On today's episode of Real Ghost Stories Online, a young boy narrowly escapes death during a disaster thanks to a familiar voice. Also, two men in the Navy must find the courage to perform their duties in the most terrifying of circumstances. Those stories and more on the Halloween edition 2017 of Real Ghost Stories Online. Tony and Jenny Brewski joining you once again.
Hi.
And how are you this fine day?
Good. How are you?
Good. You can open those shades if you'd like, if you don't like the darkness over there.
It's okay. I'm not going to take my headphones off and hop down and do it.
We have like a button or something.
Yeah.
Boom.
That would have been nice.
That'd be kind of neat. But unfortunately, we don't. Some interesting stories here today. These some longer ones. And these are some of my favorite are when they're longer and you can really kind of get into it.
Yeah.
So how long did it, how long have you been holding on to these? Or have they just kind of come through in the last recent history?
The last few months.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Any former writers from previous episodes or that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of.
So these could be brand new.
Yeah.
All right. I'm excited. 855-853-4802 is our phone number here at Real Ghost Stories Online to share your stories with us. Of course, you can write it on the website, realghoststoriesonline.com. This show goes on far beyond Halloween, so press subscribe and you'll continue to get ghost stories all throughout the year, every single week. So please do that if you've been enjoying the show this this past month of October. Let's jump right into it on today's episode and go into our first story. It's coming into us from Philip. And Philip starts out by saying, I can still feel my foot when it rains. It's been gone for over 70 years, but I have moments where I feel as though I can run through the fields just as I did when I was a carefree boy. Yet, it is gone. But there are other things that work that way, too. Ghostly. People, places, sounds, smells. They can all linger even after they're no more. My foot was traded for memories that I would gladly give back, even if it meant that I must relive all my days once again. When you're a 13-year-old boy, a day home from school for a sour stomach is not really a day off. All your buddies are still in school, so you'd almost rather be there, going about your day, studying your lessons, and pestering your teacher. The punishment of illness felt even harsher on that beautiful April day. The birds outside beckoned for me to join them in the sun, yet I knew if I left my bed, my breakfast, and last night's dinner would be back without mercy for my poor mama to clean up. So in my bed I stayed. Mama had walked down the street to the drugstore to try and get something to ease my discomfort, in a hope that I could go back to school tomorrow, and out from underfoot. My father, as always, had left before the sun was up, headed to the docks. His only goodbye was a familiar slam of the kitchen screen door. He was always a quiet man, and we knew that he loved us, but his days were long, and he always returned with barely enough strength to make it out the door. My kid sister, Irene, had gone with Mama to be dropped off at school, only after her ornery self had a big laugh at my moaning and wailing as she jumped on my bed, trying to get me to vomit. She was almost successful. I was glad Irene was in school, at least until lunchtime, when she would return with new ideas to torment me. But nothing can get to a boy as bad as boredom. I was in too much discomfort to sleep it off. I tossed and turned, but the orange glow of sunshine could still be seen through my closed eyelids. As I rolled onto my side, I opened my eyes and saw the book on my desk that I had received as a Christmas present. It was covered in a fine layer of dust. I had laid there since the day it was given to me, but it looked to be my only escape from my current misery. My sweet aunt thought I might enjoy it, although it cost her a pretty penny. I felt guilty that I had no interest in reading it, but it was all I had right then. It was a book about a boy and his red pony, but all it did was remind me of the things that I didn't have, such as a pony. There wasn't any way I could make it to the kitchen to at least listen to the radio without getting sick, so begrudgingly I began to read the book. After a few pages of a slow introduction, I noticed the birds all went quiet. Everything was in complete silence. What I heard next was so loud that I screamed out in agony. It sounded like my home and everything in it was run over by a speeding freight train. I was thrown off my bed and onto the hard floor by a force equally as strong as it was loud. The brick exterior of my bedroom was crumbled in on top of me. Chunks of my home hit my body like hard punches in a playground fight. The glass in my bedroom window blew in like a million pieces of dust. I could feel it in my eyes. I could feel the warm blood running down my cheek. As I lay on the floor of my bedroom, I could hardly breathe under the heavy weight of the walls of what had been my house. I could feel the ground beneath me shaking. Then, just as quickly as the wave of terror hit, it was gone. Sounds of a quiet April day were replaced with women's screams and the groans of twisted wreckage and crumbling walls. It felt like something had a hold of my leg and its large jaws pinching it tighter and tighter. I screamed as I could feel the skin on my leg cooking under the pressure of the hot iron. I could smell my own flesh burning. I slowly raised my head with all my strength. The last thing I saw before I passed out from the pain was what I had a hold of my leg. It was a Buick. I don't honestly know how long I was out. Could have been minutes, could have been hours. As I started to come to, I could hear screams and crying outside in the distance. The pain in my leg was tremendous, but strangely, it no longer burned from heat. There was a light roar in the distance that I could make out, but I had no idea where it was coming from. There was a smell of burning, which quickly sent me into a panic. I had no idea what was on fire. It smelled like a trash fire that had gotten out of control. That was the smell of everything burning. I couldn't see what was on fire. Blood obscured my eyes. Looking back, I think it was a blessing that I couldn't see what was around me. Such absolute devastation and horror. But I couldn't move. I couldn't see. I was trapped. I heard my name being called faintly, yet in a frantic tone in the distance. "Philip, Philip, I'm here," I whispered. My breathing was labored from the weight of the piles of brick that had been my house moments ago. My strength was gone. I felt with every breath I let out, less air went back in and was replaced with smoke. I was being squeezed to death by the weight of the debris. "Where are you?" the voice called. I felt so helpless, I literally couldn't utter a sound to save my life. "Philip, where are you?" The voice was closer this time, and I could tell it was my father. Relief set in that he was coming for me, and once again I passed out. "Philip, I'm here." My father's voice was the first sound I heard as I once again regained consciousness. "I'm here, and I'm going to help," he said. "No, Daddy, don't go. It hurts." "I have to go get you help," he replied. "I can't lift this off you myself. I'm scared," was all I could admit to him at that moment. He'd always taught me to try and be a tough guy and never show fear, but I felt that was beat. This had me, and this may be my last moments, and I just wanted him to stay with me. I felt his hand brushing back the hair on my face as he began to yell out for help. It seemed like hours before I began to hear the voices of several men gathering around. I could feel the debris move next to me as the men climbed in the pile of brick. When one saw me, "Here, we've got one here. They began to dig, and I could feel each brick they moved off my battered body. When they reached me, they began to pull me out my arms as I gave a scream. My leg was still pinned. They began searching through the rubble for something they could use to wedge under the car to lift it enough and pull me out. After several tries, my mangled lower leg and foot were freed. I called out for my father, but his voice was lost amongst the other men's. The men picked me up and laid me on the stretcher, and I was carried several blocks to a truck that would eventually get me to a hospital. The newly familiar smell of burning flesh and the sounds that I heard people make as I was being carried are what still haunts my dreams. I remember getting to the hospital, and that's about it. Doctors must have put me out, because my memory is fuzzy, but I awoke and my foot was gone. They had determined that it had to be amputated. One of my eyes were bandaged, and the other had been cleaned up, but my vision was still blurry. My body ached. I had casts in both legs and one of my arms. I couldn't move because the pain was so severe. As I lay there, I saw a blurry movement from the corner of my room and quickly realized that my mother was there. She'd been brought with Irene to the hospital once she found out that I had been dug out of the rubble. She grabbed my hand. "Philip, I'm here, baby." "Mama," I asked. "Yes, Irene and I are here." "You okay?" I murmured, as each word I spoke became softer and more fatigued. "Yes, baby, we're fine." I rested for several minutes before I could utter the words. "What happened?" Mama's voice cracked as she said, "Ship down at the docks caught fire and blew up. Nearly the whole town's gone." Again, I lay there trying to process in my adolescent mind the fact that my entire world had just been blown to pieces and everything I'd ever known was gone. The only thing I could utter in a faint whisper was, "Daddy." I could hear Mama choking up on the lump in her throat, and she said, "We don't know." Then she paused before continuing, "He was down there when it blew." I knew that he couldn't have been down there. He was with me. He found me. He was there when they pulled me out. I was positive that he must be somewhere else in the hospital. All I could say was, "He's alive." Mama just stroked the hair from my forehead the way Daddy had done just hours earlier and said, "I hope so." I still believe, as an 83-year-old man, that my daddy was there with me that day. But in what way he was there is still what I don't understand. Some say that I was hallucinating from the pain, but I don't agree. They never found any trace of his body, along with the 112 others that were listed as missing. The explosion killed at least 581 people from my small hometown of Texas City, Texas. I know that my daddy died that day, but I also know he never really will.
I think it's amazing that he was there to help this little boy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know what to say.
I mean, it's quite a story. I was like, my mind going through this going, what disaster is this? What disaster is
yeah.
this? And at first I thought, oh, maybe it's just the car that ran into the house. But then as it kind of expounding upon mm-hmm. more and more stuff, like, this sounds much bigger than that. Because then the explosion, I thought, oh, is it Halifax? But this would be, that was like, maybe far too back for this to be written.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it sounds like, you know, his dad came for comfort. What I wonder is the dad ghost, was the dad ghost aware he was dead?
It's hard to know. I mean, mm-hmm. I think whether I was alive or dead, I'd be trying to get to my kid.
Sure.
I think whether I was alive or dead would be the last thought I'd have on my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering if he's, you know, one of those things where you're just, you know, if boom, you're just in, you know, you are aware something horrible happened and you're going to try and get to your family. And you're just in the adrenaline rush of going and doing that. You're not realizing that you're dead
mm-hmm.
until after all is said and done. Like, wait a second. Nobody's hearing me. Nobody's seeing me. And maybe that was part of it where, you know, he was trying to go and find people. And then it kind of got blurry there where he was like, why is no one helping? Why is no one hearing?
Sure.
You know, I wonder if that's part of it. Great story. Thank you for writing in and sharing that experience with us. Was this submitted by what we assume the author here, the person who experienced this?
Yeah.
Wow. Very, very cool. Thank you for doing that. We do greatly appreciate you sharing your experience with us here on the program. 855-853-4802 is our phone number here at Real Ghost Stories Online. Hey, if you want to get freaked out even more after you're done listening to our Halloween episode of Real Ghost Stories Online, be sure to check out the new podcast called Haunted Places. It's not our podcast. It's a totally different podcast, but it is a good one, and they are the supporters of today's episode of Real Ghost Stories Online. It's just jam-packed with paranormal stuff. Check it out. Haunted Places. Every haunted place on Earth has a frightening, real backstory. It tells the story of how a normal place can become a paranormal minefield. The hosts of Haunted Places take you on an audio tour of the haunted place and its haunted history in every single episode. Each episode of Haunted Places shares the creepy stories that explain how these places became the resting grounds for lingering spirits and paranormal activity. It's kind of like a campfire story. Spooky legends, weird history, tales of the supernatural from people who've experienced it firsthand. Haunted Places and their team of researchers delve into the detailed stories of death, neglect, and unresolved fates that linger in the fabrics of these very haunted places. Check out every episode covering the Cecil Hotel and Marie Laveau right now. New episodes come out every other Thursday. And subscribe to Haunted Places to hear their new podcasts on the Eastern State Penitentiary and many, many more. Visit Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts and search for Haunted Places. Again, HauntedPlaces. Or visit Paracast.com/haunted and start listening right now. That's Paracast, Paracast.com/haunted to listen right now. And thanks for supporting our show today, Haunted Places. Continuing on to our next story. Dennis writes in, is this a horror story? I'd rather not use that word because it involves one of my very best friends in the distant past, and there was no horror in the event I will describe. Let's just say extremely unsettling to me, at least. And you might term it as a paranormal event, whatever that is, and let it go as that. Is it a true story? Believe what you will, or of it, or what you won't, it happened. I just want to get it on paper. Yes, I have dreams, but the event that causes them was not a dream. As I sit here at my computer writing this story, I don't see any fiery sunrises or dark clouds looming or sense aura about me, and I didn't wake up trembling when the alarm went off or any of that nonsense. I'm up early, as usual, after one of those dreams of which I've had so many over the years. The same dream. Me talking to my best friend, Bill. Close to the bow of our ship, the USS Henry County, nicknamed the Hawk. The same conversation over and over, word for word, but that will be told in this story. I've been reluctant to tell my story for obvious reasons. Back then, I didn't dare tell it for fear of being medically discharged from the Navy for being a nut job, and for years afterwards because of my work in security, which sometimes brought me into contact with the government. But now retired and disabled veteran, what difference does it make? Maybe some therapy for me by getting it out and talking about it. Maybe and maybe not. It's worth a try. I joined the Navy in Hammond, Indiana in 1960. After boot camp in San Diego, I was assigned to the USS Henry County, a landing ship tank assigned to amphibious forces. Our job was to carry troops and their tanks, hit the beach, open the huge bow doors, and they'd roll off ashore, and we'd pull off and head back to sea. We only had a crew of 192 men, including officers. We also had a flat bottom, which meant we bounced and wallowed a lot to wherever we were going. After going on board and getting settled in, I was assigned to the engineering department. I'd be working as a boiler technician. I started out as a fireman apprentice and then fireman and was soon promoted to boiler technician, third class, and was then put in charge of the boiler room. That was as high as I rose in the 4 years I served. The day after I boarded the Hawk, many of the crew members were coming to me and introducing themselves and telling me where they were from. One of the guys was Bill, tall and lanky, dark-haired sailor from Hershey, Pennsylvania. We hit it off immediately and soon became best buddies. Bill had come on board only 3 weeks before I had. He was an engineerman and rose in rank right along with me. We had many adventures in California. One of our favorite places to meet girls was Knott's Berry Farm, an old western-style ghost town set up for visitors. One day while there, we met Cindy and Carol, who were sisters. Carol was 1 year older than Cindy. We hit it off big time. I gravitated towards Cindy immediately, and Bill did the same with Carol. It's always been amazing to me how things like that work out. I really liked Cindy, but felt a little guilty at times because I had a girl back home. Her name was Linda, and she had the most beautiful long hair in the world. She's also beautiful. We've gone steady for a couple years before I joined the Navy and had discussed our possible future together. I received a letter from Linda at least twice a month, and I always wrote back. I had talked with Bill about her several times, but Bill was hung up on us going to Australia after the Navy. He constantly talked about it. According to Bill, we could become rich in Australia mining for opals, which he said were everywhere down under. His plan was that we would go to San Francisco after the Navy, catch a steamer headed for Australia. We'd work below decks in the boiler room for free passage. Bill had it all figured out. He said, "We'll only be gone a couple of years, and you can go back and marry Linda with plenty of money in your pockets." He had talked me into it. All the fun would soon be over. At the end of 1961, Russia resumed nuclear weapons testing, ordered by Khrushchev. In early 1962, President John Kennedy announced we would do the same to answer the threat. The Henry County was selected to be one of the ships participating in the tests. We steamed out of Long Beach on July 12, 1962, headed for Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, where we would resupply food, fuel, and fresh water. From there, we'd steam to what was termed the Johnston Christmas Island Danger Zone, designated Operation Dominic. We would be steaming between Johnston and Christmas Island, participating in the tests. After 9 days at sea, we sighted Diamond Head lying off our starboard side. We continued down to enter the channel that would lead us to the Pearl Harbor Naval Base, where we would tie up. The next night, after berthing at pier, a sailor they called Suds, Bill, and I hit the beach. We stopped at a little tiki bar in Waikiki that advertised live entertainment. We discussed the upcoming deployment to the Johnston Christmas Island Danger Zone for those nuclear tests. Suds had known a couple guys who were on a bikini back in 1958 for tests. One was now dead and one was dying. "It's not a good thing, guys. Not good at all. We will more or less be guinea pigs. I just don't want to be one of the poor guys who must go topside and take radiation readings after they drop one of those bastards. I want my rear to be deep, deep below decks." I went to the bar and got us three more drafts. Grabbed our beers, headed back to the table. When I arrived, the conversation had changed. Bill and Suds were in a discussion about poetry. Bill was talking about a man named Shelley, a name I vaguely remembered from high school literature class. Suds said Shelley had a fascination with death. "Just read his Queen Mab, and you'll see what I mean." Bill said he had read it and it was one of his favorites. Bill said death has a beauty of its own. In fact, maybe the most beautiful part of life. I was a little surprised when Suds said, I've heard you write a little poetry. And Bill said, "I dabble at it. It's not very good, but I enjoy it." They were thinking, out of my league. So I just sat there sipping my beer. Bill sensed then that said this. "Do you have a favorite poet, Den?" I said, "Well, sorta. I like that Poe guy, I guess. In the poem where he looks for El Dorado. I guess that's about it." Suds sort of smiled as if I had said I preferred comic books to John Steinbeck. Bill picked up on that and quickly said, "Poe has always been underappreciated. He was actually an extremely profound writer." I don't know where Bill was getting words like profound from, but I was glad to see it. Wiped the smirk off Suds' face. There wasn't much action going on in the little bar, and we didn't care. We were all three worn out and ready to go hit our racks early. At muster the next morning, it was announced that three men had been chosen to attend radiology school for 5 days. These men were second-class electrician's mates, Howard Sayers, third-class boiler technician Dennis Smith, third-class engineerman William Baylor. There were over 80 men in the radiology class. Larger ships had as many as a dozen men on their radiology teams. The Hawk was small, so she rated just three. We were each issued a numbered Mueller-Geiger counter that we had to sign for. Each man would be responsible for the care and maintenance of its counter until the end of the tests when they would be turned in. We were instructed in calibrating the instruments to take radiation readings. These readings would be read as Russians. We also learned about ionizing radiation and its half-life. We learned about alpha and beta particles and gamma rays. We were trained in wash-down procedures and the base surge that would emanate from the detonation of an atomic bomb, much like the circle that radiated from a stone being thrown into a pond, only tremendously larger in scale. This was a huge wave that would slap the side of a ship, causing it to list severely on the opposite side. 3 days after the classes ended, we pulled away from our pier and headed down the channel and to the sea on our way to Johnston Island, which was just an atoll. There seemed to be a natural stillness about the base as the Hawk steamed slowly up the channel, headed for the open sea. It was still dark with a faint light to the east. No other vessels were moving in either direction. I was alone on the fantail with my thoughts. I threw my cigarette overboard and headed below decks. The further we steamed southwest, the more reality seemed to become suspended. Even the sea looked different, darker. No phosphorus streaks brightened the wake behind the Hawk. Stars were becoming rare. It was impossible to tell where the sky ended and the sea started. There was no horizon. A black dome seemed to have been placed over the sea where the Hawk was steaming. Even breathing was difficult. On our third night of steaming, it seemed that every man not on watch was topside. The old salts who had been at sea for years had bewildered looks on their faces. Old Doc Bailey, a chief corpsman who had sailed on all seven seas, shook his head. These latitudes are not meant for men. This is Satan's playground. Satan and his demons. Just as Doc finished his sentence, the southern sky flashed a bright white light, brighter than any sun. Then it turned greenish hue, and then it was gone. Somebody said, "What in God's name?" And Doc said, "That was a nuclear airburst. We haven't even reached our destination yet. But we're going to see the bastards up close for real." The light rain started to fall, and we all headed below decks. At 0500 hours on the third day, we began approaching Johnston Island, which was really not an island, but just an atoll. We anchored 1,000 yards out from the break wall that had been built around it. We were issued a dosimeter, a small black round object that would hang from a cord around our necks. We were told these would read from time to time to detect how many radiogens we're being exposed to. They never were. The uniform of the day would be t-shirts and dungaree pants because of the heat. Bill, Howard, Sayers, and I were seated on the deck just inside the port hatch. We were all three wearing asbestos firefighting suits. Sweat was pouring from our bodies inside the suits. The only part not made of asbestos was the plexiglass in front of our eyes to see through. Howard muttered something about us looking like creatures from a B-grade science fiction movie. My body was itching. My face was itching. There was no way to scratch. Howard said he was having trouble breathing. We each were holding our Mueller-Geiger counters. We knew a B-52 had left Hickman headed our way with a payload. It'd be a surface drop of a multi-metagen nuclear bomb. It would be detonated at a certain altitude for the rainbow effect. These drops were designated airbursts. We had no idea where the Hawk's position would be in relation to the drop. The damage control teams were seated in the mess hall below us. The rest of the crew were at their general quarter stations. The drop was designated Shot Chama. We had no idea what that meant either. The countdown was blared throughout the ship, D-7 minutes. We three looked at each other. Howard shrugged. It was all he knew to do. D-20 seconds. And the countdown began. 19, 18, 17, 16, 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The overhead lights blinked off and on, and I could hear the engines changing speeds, trying to maintain some sort of station. The engine shut down, and then there was silence. The speakers blared. Brace for base surge. We have been warned about the base surge in radiology school. 10 seconds to base surge. The countdown began. 3, 2, 1. It was like a giant hand had slapped the side of the Hawk. I was thrown against a bulkhead behind me, and Bill's head slammed into the bulkhead behind him. Howard hung on the rung to keep from being thrown down the ladder to the next deck. The Hawk took a 20-degree list to starboard and then bobbed back up on an even keel. On the deck under us, we could hear the damage control party saying, "What the hell? Mary, mother of God!" The ship's speakers crackled. Damage control teams to port and starboard shafts alleys for damage inspection. Report to CIC. Radiology team lay topside. That was us. We got the hatch undogged and stepped outside. The heat was worse than inside. Daylight was just breaking. The sky on the southern horizon was unnaturally white with a greenish hue. It was like being on another planet looking at an alien sky. We headed out in a different direction. I went midships on the starboard side, working my way forward. I slowly ran the counter's probe wand over the railing. The meter fluctuated between 30 and 40 rotogens. I ran it over a horse rack and it hit 50 rotogens as the clicks per minute increased. These are pretty much the average readings I received over my area. I dutifully logged in locations and the readings. The radiology team met back at the port hatch 30 minutes later. Howard's reading had been about the same as mine, so were Bill's, except for the forward gun mount, where his needle had pegged. We noticed the greenish hue in the sky had become larger. Then the rain came. We headed below deck, stripped down, and hit the showers. Doc stationed himself outside the shower stalls at the zone Geiger counter. I had my shower running with only cold water. It felt good. I let it hit me full in the face for a long time, trying to get rid of the stink of the damned asbestos suit before I started soaping down. Howard came out first, and he stood with his arms out and legs spread while Doc ran the wand over him. There was no clicking from the Geiger counter. I came out next and assumed the position. Doc pronounced me clean. Bill came out, and there was some clicking under his right armpit. He went back in the shower, and when he came back out, the clicking continued. He headed back into the shower, and when he came back out the third time, the clicking had stopped. Bill was clean. Mr. Lingen came in and talked with us while we were getting dressed, and he looked at our logs and whistled when he saw the high readings Bill had picked up in the forward gun mount. He said, "I need to get these up to the captain right away," and took off with the log sheets. The next test was 2 days later. This time, the weapon would be carried aloft by a Thor missile and detonated under the ionosphere above all of us. All hands were required to observe this one. It was designated Bluebird. We were each issued a pair of dark goggles with 1-inch thick lenses. At 01 hours, we were all seated topside with our knees pulled up. Even with our goggles, you had to bury your head into your arms because the initial flash would blind you. The control room on the island was coming through the ship's speakers. Bluebird has left the island. Stand by. We didn't need to be told that. We're close enough to see the Thor missile lift from its pad and hear the roar and see the flame. It quickly disappeared into the blackness of the night. We waited, and then the countdown. D-minus 30 seconds, we buried our hands and closed our eyes. And then 3, 2, 1. With the goggles on, my face barren in my arms and my eyes still shut, I still saw a flash of light. We waited, and the speakers came alive. All hands may now observe detonation. We removed our goggles, looked up. The sky was on fire. A deep, dark, boiling red covering the entire sky. There seemed to be lightning bolts flashing through it. There were audible gasps all around me. I heard an unknown voice somewhere behind me. "Now we know what hell looks like." Somebody else said, "The hell we do. This shit would scare the piss out of Satan." Then a band of light appeared, arcing from horizon to horizon. The ship's speaker came alive, telling us we were looking at the Van Allen radiation belt. Some of the guys had already left, and the rest of us went below. Everybody was quiet, getting ready to get back to their racks. The usual horseplay and laughter was muted. Somebody propped open the overhead scuttle to let in some air. It was raining again. We steamed south to Palmyra Island and anchored just outside the lagoon. We were here for what the Navy called R&R, rest and relaxation, hot dogs, hamburgers. We were even allowed beer bought from Johnston Island. Some of the guys were in the lagoon splashing around. A baseball game was underway. Bill, Suds, Howard, several guys from Deck Force and Operations and I had a game of tag football going. The longer our game went, the more competitive it became, and pretty soon the tagging was replaced by full contact tackling. Bill and Suds and their crew were on the opposite team from me and Howard and our guys. When it finally ended, we were bloody, we had bloody noses, torn t-shirts. Don't even remember which side won, but it was great fun. Everybody seemed to be in a good mood, and we piled aboard the LCVPs, and the sun was setting. Bill sat down on a corner of the boat and said, "Man, I must really be out of shape. Damn, I'm tired. I ache in every bone." I said, "Hell, we all do," Sud said. "What about the old guy like me? I'm 32 years old. How do you guys think I feel? You young whippersnappers shouldn't be tired." "Hell, I'm the one who's tired," we all grinned. Bill didn't feel like eating chow that night. He said, "They've got ice cream. Do you want me to bring you a bowl?" He thought a second. "Nah, I don't think so." After chow, I went back to berthing the area to get Bill for the movie, but he was sound asleep. I went back to the mess hall and watched a goofy movie called Duel of the Titans. They were speaking English, but it was dubbed in because the actors' lips weren't in sync with the words. Halfway through, just about everyone walked out, including me. Revile came at about 5:30, when I jumped out of my rack and I noticed Bill was already up. I tied a towel around my waist, grabbed my shaving kit, and stumbled to the head. An engineer man named Mosley was shaving in the sink next to mine. Never cared much for Mosley. He resembled a chipmunk to me. Buck teeth and all. He said, "Where's your buddy, Baylor?" I said, "Probably looking for you two to whip your butt." Mosley was patting cheap aftershave on his jaws. "No, man, I'm serious. He was supposed to stand in the mid-watch on the auxiliary engines. I went to wake him, but he wasn't in his rack. Hell, I couldn't find him anywhere." Mac had to take the watch. I went back to my rack and climbed into my dungarees and boom dockers. I headed to the mess hall to grab a cup of coffee and climbed the ladder to the main deck, which I did alone most mornings to gather my thoughts and to try to catch a breeze of some sort. As I moved forward, I saw Bill up by the forward gun tub. When I got to him, I said, "Where in the hell have you been, buddy? A lot of guys are looking for you. You didn't relieve the watch last night." Bill said, "I know I didn't." That concerned me a little. I said, "Are you okay, Bill?" He smiled. "Actually, I feel better than I've ever felt in my life." That also disconcerted me for some reason. Bill had a strange aura about him, as though he was glowing just a little. It had to be the rising sun to his back causing the effect, but he also had a very slight scent of cinnamon about him, which made no sense. For some reason, we started talking about our adventures, Carol and Cindy, the fun we had at the Rose Bowl parade in Pasadena on New Year's Eve 1960. We laughed and talked for an hour. Finally, I said, "Well, let's go get some chow, buddy, before it's all gone." Bill said, "Not now. I'll be down in a little while, maybe." I said, "Make it quick. I'll be gone." As I turned to leave, Bill stopped me, putting his arm around my shoulder, and he said, "About that Australia thing, that was just a pipe dream. I want you to promise me you'll take care of yourself and go home and marry that raven-haired girl you talk about. She's waiting for you." I said, "How would you know that?" He smiled again. "I just know. Believe me, I do. Hell, I might even be at the wedding if you have one, if you'll have me." I said, "We'll talk about it later," and headed down below for some chow. After leaving the mess hall, I headed down the passageway that led by the sick bay where old Doc Bailey ruled the roost. As I passed, the hatch door was open, and I noticed someone was on the hospital bed with a sheet over his head. I stuck my head in and said, "Who you got there, Doc?" He shook his head. "It's your friend Bill Smitty. I'm afraid we've lost him. He woke me up around 2300 hours saying he was in pain everywhere. I got him in here and he started throwing up and I gave him something to put him out, but he was gone before he even swallowed it." I stumbled back against the bulkhead and I said, "You're crazy, Doc. I just talked to him a short time ago up topside." Doc reached over and pulled the hatch shut and dogged it down. Doc said, "Listen to me, Smitty. I'm under the Navy near 20 or near 30 years. World War II and the Korean conflict, and I've seen it all. I've seen too many dead men, and I've heard what you're saying many times. Bottom line is, I believe you talked to Bill on the main deck earlier because I've seen this before. But the fact is, your good friend has been dead close to 8 hours and lying right here." He pulled a little of the sheet back, and it was Bill. A cold shiver ran down my back. My hands were shaking. Doc grabbed my arm and said, "Get a hold of yourself. As I've told you, what happened to you is not all that uncommon, but if you have any sense at all, you'll keep it between us. You want an honorable discharge when you get out, not a Section 8. You won't be able to get a job at a dump. Just let it go, Smitty." I nodded okay, but the chill was still with me. Doc said, I've notified a captain. Hospital boat's on its way to take Bill back to the island, where I'll be flown to Hawaii and back to Pennsylvania. Doc handed me a key. In the meantime, I want you to go to his locker and get all his things out and bring them back here so they can go with him. I know you'd be the one he would want to do it. The chill was still running up and down my spine as I went to get Bill's sea bag and then to his locker to put all his things in it. While going through his locker, I found a piece of paper with Bill's handwriting. It looked as though he had started a poem of some kind, but hadn't finished it. I slipped the piece of paper into my own pocket and still have it. I carried it all back up to sick bay, still totally bewildered. When I got back, Mr. Lingen was in the sick bay. He told me he was sorry about Bill, and we shook hands. A loudspeaker announced that the hospital boat had pulled alongside, and two of Doc's corpsmen put Bill on the stretcher and carried him topside. As the stretcher was being lowered to the hospital boat, I yelled out, "Be careful with him." One of the corpsmen on the boat said, we will, don't worry. Old Doc, Mr. Lingen, Suds, and I stood there and watched the boat until it went behind the breaker wall at Johnston Island. As we turned to go below decks, Doc said he wanted to see me in the sick bay. I followed him down. Doc gave me some kind of pill and a glass of water and told me to swallow it. He said, I'm giving you an off-duty slip for today. I want you to get in your rack and stay there. Again, I believe you told the truth. But also, again, I'm telling you that if you value your future, you'll keep your mouth shut. I nodded in agreement and headed for my rack. I was already growing drowsy. I slept a dreamless sleep for 9 hours. We endured 3 more surface drops with only Howard and me on the radiology team. We also witnessed 3 more detonations in the ionosphere. For these, we also wore heavy goggles with our heads buried in our laps until the initial flash passed. Even then, you could hear men yell out that they could see their own bones like an X-ray. I saw mine once in my left leg but didn't say anything. On November 16th, the Hawk was the last ship to depart Johnston Island. We never knew why we were required to stay another 3 days after everyone else left. We were all tired to the bone. We were also hungry for something real to eat. We had run out of groceries a week earlier, and we were subsisting on powdered eggs, Spam, powdered potato, and powdered milk. The refrigerated reefer ship that was on its way to Johnston Island to resupply us never showed up. We had no idea what the situation was on the larger ships. They're sure as hell, they didn't offer us anything. At 0200 hours on November 19th, we tied up to appear in Pearl. In August 1964, I received an honorable discharge and headed back to Indiana. The dreams started a month or so after I returned home. Bill and I talking that morning up by the forward gun tub. All of it, word for word, the scent of cinnamon, the aura of light right up to me heading below decks. But it wasn't that often, maybe once every 2 months or so. Everyone on board the Hawk signed paperwork that nothing we saw or heard at Operation Dominic would not be revealed to anyone for 30 years, which would be 1992, and I've honored that. I went to work for Rand McNally in Hammond and then sold insurance for a while, but that was just not for me. I then was trained as a decoder and went to work for a security firm that had contacts with the government. And Linda and I married a year later. As the years wore on, strangely, the dreams increased. It's now to the point after all these years that the same dream comes to me at least once a week and sometimes even more often. It's very stressful on me, and I always wake up with a depressed feeling after one of the dreams. I recently finally told my wife about it. My wife was originally from Alabama, and after I retired, we moved here and have a place on the lake which does have a somewhat of a calming effect. She's tried to help me in every way she can, and I don't know what I would do without her. I do have a VA psychiatrist at the Veterans Hospital in Birmingham who I only see about once a year because of being diagnosed with PTSD from the stress. I never discuss the dreams with him. I've told him I have dreams about the test but don't go into the details as I have here. I also have some severe pain in my back with both legs, which 2 VA doctors have told me may very well be caused by the ionizing radiation. I also have asbestos in my lungs from wearing the asbestos firefighting suit during the tests and working with asbestos on a daily basis down in the boiler rooms of the Hawk. The VA has me at 90% disabled. I certainly don't mind having dreams about my friend. I'd like to have dreams about some of our adventures, but it's the same dream, word for word, over and over. Linda is the one who told me I should write about it because it might be therapeutic for me. I can only hope it is. Hoping and praying.
I know that that's got to be extremely difficult to keep reliving that dream.
Mm-hmm.
But at least it was a positive encounter.
Yeah, it wasn't a traumatic moment.
No.
Of him dying in his arms or something horrible.
Which could have very well happened in the situation they were in.
Exactly. And then having to relive that over and over. At least it was him and his buddy talking about his future and happy thoughts.
I think it's very telling, though, that the doctor's seen that a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't doubt it.
And I don't doubt to that this day that they don't say the same thing.
Yeah.
Of don't speak about it. And then 30 years later, we get the stories on the show.
Yeah.
So just think.
Right.
Get some interesting ones coming up here in 30 more years.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you for sharing that experience with us. We do greatly appreciate you sending that into our program. If you like our show, if you like Real Ghost Stories Online, like I said, this is a show that we do year round. You can subscribe on whatever platform it is you're listening to us on so you don't miss any episodes. And even more so, if you want our best stories, the best ones that we get in, we do it every single week in our EPP bonus episodes, which you can find at ghostpodcast.com. That is our website where you can go and download all, like we're up to nearly 170 some bonus episodes now. You can download all of them. It's only $5 a month. That's what goes to support the show and really keep it on the air. So check that out at ghostpodcast.com. Or you can sign up for a full year membership, get one of those months free, and claim your bonus item, including a bunk bed bell, or even a one-on-one call with us where you can share your ghost story. We'll discuss it back and forth in a full-blown conversation and put it possibly on the show. So that's another option you can choose for a yearly membership. So check that out at ghostpodcast.com. If you like the show, help keep us on the air. Until next time, for Jenny Brewski and Tony Brewski, happy Halloween.